شهر الطاعة والإيمان، شهر الرحمة والغفران، شهر الطاعة والإيمان، شهر الرحمة والغفران.
أيامك خير الأيام
يا رمضان،
يا شهر صيام وقيام
يا رمضان.
أيامك خير الأيام
يا رمضان،
يا شهر صيام وقيام
يا رمضان.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين. سلام عليكم ورحمة الله. We were discussing riya. In relation to fasting, one of the unique aspects to it, which other acts of worship do not have, is the fact that it's secretive in nature, i.e. it's concealed before others. When it's concealed before others, because fasting is a list of do nots, don't do this, don't do that, at least in the realm of the Sharia, it's secretive in nature, it's concealed, unlike Salat and Hajj, and therefore no one knows you're doing it, and therefore the doors of riya are almost closed. The doors of canonical riya are certainly closed. And that is a very big help, a big assistance here. It's one step forward. It's an advantage. Whereas with the others, one is constantly open to the threat of riya. So, the scholars like Sayyid Haydar Amuli says, look, this is one of the reasons why fasting has been portrayed in such a good light, because you really can reach a very high maximum with fasting, easier than with other actions. Why? Because the doors of there's no riya in fasting. Now, here Sayyid Ibn Tawus has certain things in this regard, but before we start his writing, or reading his writing, there's one verse of the Holy Quran I just want to highlight. That's in chapter 5, verse 3. حُرِّمَتْ عَلَيْكُمُ الْمَيْتَةُ وَالدَّمُ وَلَحْمُ الْخِنْزِيرِ وَمَا أُهِلَّ لِغَيْرِ اللَّهِ بِهِ وَالْمُنْخَنِقَةُ وَالْمَوْقُوذَةُ. The verse starts with things that are prohibited upon the believers, such as dead animals that aren't slaughtered, like carcasses, blood, the meat of pigs, the flesh of pigs, or those animals which have been dedicated for other than Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now all these, one can speak a lot here, especially in the esoteric dimensions of each of these, but I don't want to discuss that here. But then it gives two classes of animals that are also prohibited. Those animals that are strangled to death, since they're not slaughtered according to Islamic etiquette, they would be regarded as najis. And it would be haram to consume. But they would be najis, canonically impure. They are those who are strangled to death, or those who are mawqudha, who are beaten to death. So these two classes of animals, of cattle, you can't consume them. They're najis. They're canonically impure. Now, with verses of the Quran, every verse of the Quran has an inner meaning. إِنَّ لِلْقُرْآنِ ذَهْرًا وَبَتْنًا. With every verse of the Quran, there's a ظاهري, superficial, external, prima facie meaning, but also at the same time there's an infinite number of inner esoteric meanings. It's the esoteric meanings which we have to reach and incorporate, not suffice with the zahiri, exoteric, external dimension of Islam and the Quran and the du'as and even all aspects of Islam. Now, here, what is the esoteric meaning of animals who are strangled to death or beaten to death? Here, the scholars of the spirit of the law, the experts of the tariqah, because the tariqah is a study of the inner esoteric dimensions of Islam, whereas the Sharia is a study of the external aspects of Islam, the letter of the law. Both are important. And actually the Sharia is more important priority-wise, because without the Sharia, you can't succeed in relation to the tariqah. They come hand in hand, because it's one reality. You can't throw one aspect, dimension of that one reality away and stick to another. It has to come part and parcel. It's one reality, two sides of the same coin. Anyway, here they say the animal that is strangled to death is impure canonically, and the animal beaten to death is impure canonically. Now, the esoteric meaning is that those who discipline their souls, strangle their souls' lusts, strangle their souls' whims, strangle their souls' animalistic traits, or those who beat their souls, i.e. the animalistic traits of their souls, they beat their souls, so these traits are suppressed. These people who strangle their souls to death, who beat their souls to death, death meaning the death of animalistic traits, but they do it out of riya, ostentation. These people who do these acts, because we have ascetic disciplines, is part of Islam. And Islam has assigned many ascetic disciplines. However, if you were to commit yourselves to these ascetic disciplines for the aim of riya, so others see you in a higher light, here you would be existentially najis. You've contaminated your soul so much that you become najis. Because through these ascetic practices, you've strangled, you've beaten yourself, so that you suppress all those animalistic traits, the lusts, the whims, so you can get closer to Allah. But no, with you, it was you wanted others to see you. And as a result, you would make yourself existentially najis. So that's one reference to riya in the esoteric dimensions of this verse. And there are many other verses also showing that. Now, the question which we should have opened it up before, but I forgot to mention it, was, why is riya haram? Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli says, or has said, that there are two elements in riya which make it haram. One is, and this is in relation to the canonical riya, one is because you're lying. Although this may even apply to the spiritual riya, but let's first suffice with the canonical riya. Here, with every application of riya, there's a lie associated with it. You're lying because you tell others, I'm praying, but in reality, you're neither obeying Allah nor accomplishing His command. But you're lying to others by your actions. You're lying to them. So lying is one of the very greater evils that has been delineated amongst the major sins in Islam, lying ranks almost at the top. And this shows the very ugly nature of riya. There's a lying associated with it or inside it. The second sin is the displaying of that lie, the manifesting of that lie. That is also problematic. Because in the first, you're lying to yourself. Okay? Then you're displaying it to others. So that's why riya is regarded as haram. When you dissect it and see what is it in riya which makes it haram, it all is traced back to this concept of lying. Okay. Now, Sayyid Haydar Amuli said that with fasting, the doors of riya are closed before you. Because fasting is a list of not doing things, whereas salat, praying, is a list of doing certain components of the salat, going into prostration, genuflection, and so on and so forth, sajda in ruku. And therefore, when you commit yourself to actions, you're susceptible to riya. You're now threatened. But with fasting, he said, there is no threat. Now, Sayyid Ibn Tawus, he, in his very important book, Iqbalul A'mal, there, this is a very important book, Ayatollah Hasanzade Amuli has given a list of books that for seminary students to study from day one until the end, slowly but surely. And these are ethical and irfani books, and most of them are du'as, and the meanings of the du'as, and different rituals. But for seminary students who want to have ethical irfani supervision, from very the beginning, he mentions a number of books. The final book in that list, which one may reach that level after at least 10 years, is Sahifa As-Sajjadiyya, the fourth successor to the Holy Messenger, Imam Sajjad, alayhi salam. His book of du'as, 50 odd du'as have been compiled, and they have an ocean of ma'rifah in them. It's very deep. The words are so deep. The meaning is so deep. It's just bewildering. But that's the last book. You really have to undergo a lot of preliminary steps before you can thoroughly understand the meaning of the du'as. But the penultimate book, the one before the Sahifa of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, is Sayyid Ibn Tawus's Iqbalul A'mal. Now, in that book, I want to read something. That book is divided into the months of the year and the rituals of each month. In the month of Rajab, when he mentions the mustahab fasts of the month of Rajab, he opens the concept of fasting a bit more. And he brings seven scenarios where riya can attack and be a threat to the faster. We previously said that with fasting, the doors of riya are closed. But it's not closed 100% though. There are still scenarios where you can be threatened by riya, be it the canonical riya or the spiritual riya, you may be threatened. He goes through seven different scenarios, and I'll just read the English for you. And with each one, you can evaluate yourself and then act accordingly and compensate accordingly. Now, in the first scenario, he writes, you're amongst a group of people who are also fasting, and you desire to break your fast and do so, and they become aware that you have done so. In such a state, now let's imagine this was a mustahab fast, for example. Although there may be circumstances that it can apply to a wajib fast. But let's say they were all doing a mustahab fast. And you, out of the many people who are fasting, you desire to break your fast and do so, and they become aware that you have done so. In such a state, introspect and explore within yourself and ascertain whether or not the fact that they have realized you've broken your fast, ascertain whether or not this has embarrassed you. The fact that now they know you've become embarrassed. If you reply that your soul has become embarrassed by having broken your fast in their presence, there exists ambiguity in your fast. For you have not intended proximity to Allah through such a fast. Rather, you want to be close to the group, not attaining proximity to Allah. You want to attain proximity to the group. And that's why you became embarrassed. Your fast here is ambiguous. Now, Sayyid ibn Tawus is amongst the very few scholars who, even with the spiritual riya, regards one salat. If the salat suffers from spiritual riya, he will regard that salat as void. Alhamdulillah, that the religious authorities throughout history, the majority, say no. Spiritual riya does not deem one's ibadat as void. You're just contaminating your soul. But it doesn't nullify the actual ritual. Unless someone truly fasted because of others and not to execute Allah's command, so much so that the others were a cause for them to fast. And that if they weren't there, he wouldn't or she wouldn't have fasted. That would be canonical riya, and one's fast would be deemed void. But in these seven scenarios, most of them, although the applications may vary, each has to evaluate oneself, but most of them are of the spiritual type of riya. Now, here in this example, this was in relation to an act of worship, fasting, but it can also, the spiritual riya can also be applied outside the acts of worship. For example, now here Sayyid ibn Tawus doesn't write this. I'm just extending the argument to make it more applicable. For example, you're traveling with a group to help someone or to offer medical services. A group of medics, for example, going to a desolate place to help the people there because they're suppressed of financial aid. And you embark on a group project with a group of people, but halfway through you withdraw from the group and from the project. You decide not to continue. The question now is this. Or you had to leave for whatever reason. But the question is this now. Do you feel embarrassed in front of those other medics when you leave and when you withdraw the project? If you say yes, you suffer from riya. Because you want to attain proximity with the medics, with the people. How they think of you is important, not Allah. Attaining proximity with Allah, if it was genuinely there, you wouldn't have felt embarrassed at all. Okay. Or introspect, this is the second scenario. Introspect and explore within and see whether or not You like Allah alone to be aware of your fasting? Or would you also like others to be aware? So these people, even this, even in relation to the canonical riya, if someone does salat or fast for Allah's sake, but one of the results would be that others would praise them. And they like that. It's sweet for them. And that wouldn't be an application of canonical riya, because they really did it for Allah. This was just a result, and it suited them, and they liked it. They didn't do it solely to please others, and they didn't do it, you know, avoiding obeying Allah. No, they did it to gain a proximity to Allah, but this is a result, and they like this result. So here, in this second scenario, introspect and explore within, and see whether or not you like Allah alone to be aware of your fasting. Or would you like others to be aware too? So that they value your deed, praise you, and or speak highly of you. If the latter, or if others' awareness is sweeter before you, compared to Allah being aware, Allah alone being aware, acknowledge that such a fasting is poisonous to you, and you're not a loyal person. You have no sharaf. You're not loyal before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Look how delicately this has been mentioned. Look, Sayyid Haydar Omri said the doors of Riyah are closed. But here, with these scenarios, no, they're not closed. Okay, there are spiritual states here, but still it's riyah. In the third scenario, introspect and see whether or not excessive numbers and an abundance of fasters has any effect upon your joy in fasting, i.e., were smaller numbers to fast, you would experience fasting for Allah's sake as a burden upon your shoulders, a spiritual lethargy. But were the numbers to be numerous, you would fast with joy and energy. If the former, with that spiritual lethargy, acknowledge that you want to be of the same color as people and have not in reality fasted for Allah. Because when there are small numbers, it's lethargic spiritually for you. It's a heavy load on your shoulders. You want to be the same color as people. Whereas Allah's color, being immersed in Allah, divinely immersed in Allah, that is much better. And we have this philosophy mentioned in chapter 2, verse 138. Okay. Now, here, now we enter the fourth scenario. Introspect and observe whether you fasted for Allah or for the acquisition of rewards, i.e., were the rewards mentioned and stipulated in the ahadith, as well as being safeguarded from the hellfire, which is mentioned in the ahadith, were these not to be actualized, you wouldn't have avoided eating or drinking or refraining from other pleasures that are haram during the month of Ramadan, during the daylight hours of the month of Ramadan. If there were no rewards, you wouldn't have fasted. This is very difficult in evaluating oneself. That would you have fasted if you were told there's no reward? If the latter, if you say yes, and you did it for the rewards, and that if there were no rewards, you wouldn't have fasted. If this is the case, acknowledge that you have not fasted for the sake of abiding by Allah's command. And you do not see him as worthy of servitude because of the grandeur of his might. You don't see servitude because of Allah's might. You don't see him as worthy of such servitude. And were those rewards not have been real, you would never have fasted. This is really treading on the boundaries of the canonical Sharia Riya here. Yes, but even it applies to actions even outside the Sharia, and you doing those actions because of Allah's grandeur. When you help someone, you don't help someone so that that person then returns that favor and favors you with a favor in return to what you did to them. That too is spiritual riya. You should help that person, and if you see Allah worthy of servitude as a result of his grandeur, you would never even consider being a recipient of their rewards, their favors. It's not an issue for you. You don't care. If they were to give it, you would say thank you. If they don't give it, you would say thank you to yourself. Not to them, because that may precipitate anger. It shouldn't make a difference. So you can evaluate yourself here. Now, you may say, but what about all those traditions which speak of all these actions with the rewards? Now, there are two ways of looking at this. The first is a simple way, and that is with children, you give them sweets to go to primary school. You give them better presents when they want to go to secondary school or university. But once they specialize in an area and become, for example, an oncologist, you wouldn't say, for example, someone who's researching to find a solution for cancer, you wouldn't say, do this and I'll give you some money. No, they love knowledge. They love to solve people's problems. It's important for them. Even if you don't pay them, they will continue their ways. You see? We're not a child anymore. In religion, only in the beginning, there was this reward system to push you on the path of salvation, the path of Allah, so that you acquire love of Allah, and then you don't worship him because of rewards. Okay, so, but some people, they're still the same children with the same mentality of getting the sweets, even in religion. It's the same mentality. They haven't grown at all. Another way at looking at this, and this is probably more on a par with Sayyid Ibn Tawus, is even with children, from the very beginning, you try to inculcate inside them this idea of doing it for Allah, and the rewards are secondary. They're never the goal. And if you were to be given them, you say thank you. You use them. But if you don't, it doesn't matter. Inculcate this. Now, there's a problem here. If a parent inculcates this, when the parent, him or herself, does not practice this, you're making things worse now. This kind of amr bil ma'ruf is not necessary for you, because you're going to make it worse. Because you never did it yourself, they will look at you as a hypocrite, and then they'll never take the message from you. In many cases, that's the case. And unless, for example, you deem it probable they may listen, then there may be a case for it. But at least for you, don't be a hypocrite. At least you yourself avoid being a hypocrite. And this is matters of spirituality now. So Amr Ma'ruf doesn't have that obligation associated with it. So you yourself try not to be a hypocrite. But in general, or indirectly, or through the local sheikh or lectures or and so on and so forth, this is something good to be inculcated. But it's a bit hardcore. It's a bit difficult. And that's why with children, usually, it's better to go through the system of reward, but then slowly take them out of it. And the more they appreciate Allah and Allah's grandeur, they themselves should come out of it. The more they realize Tawheed, understand Tawheed, they will themselves come out of that reward system as they grow older and older. If they don't, it's because of the lack of Tawheed. And when you see a 50, 60, 70, 100-year-old, they're still predominated and preoccupied with the rewards. In 99.9% of the cases, is because they never studied Tawheed. Tawheed for them was, once upon a time, a teacher, their parents, or said, Tawheed is God is one, not two, full stop, let's go and teach you the rituals now. They never gave themselves the opportunity to learn Tawheed. And as a result, that reward system is with them and is still with them. Yes. That was the fourth. Number five, introspect and observe how the food during feasting, the time of breaking the fast, affects you and how it affects your fasting. Either the food is luxurious food, extravagant food, lovely, tasty meat, colorful, etc. And this gives you a boost of joy and energy to fast during the day. Look how delicate this kind of riyah is. You're still threatened by riyah. It's not as if fasting closes the door. Yes, it may close the doors upon the canonical riyah, but it won't close the doors of spiritual riyah. Either the food is like that, or the food is none of these, albeit sufficient, the food's sufficient, but it's not colorful, extravagant, luxurious. And as a result of this minimum food, which is the other alternative, and as a result, you have no drive or joy in your fasting. So when you know the feasting awaiting you at night is of a luxurious type, it gives you joy and boosts your energy during the day whilst you're fasting. Fasting becomes easy because you're awaiting that. But sometimes, no. You know that that which awaits you at night is a very simple food. And albeit sufficient, but it's very simple. And then this causes a kind of a lowering of that energy level during the day. If these apply to you, acknowledge that your fasting is ambiguous. Okay. That was the fifth scenario. In the sixth scenario, suppose you fasted a number of hours with that sincerity, doing it for Allah's sake, and then wholesome food was offered to you. Now, in this scenario, this applies to recommended fasts, not obligatory fasts during the month of Ramadan. So suppose you have fasted a number of hours, with ikhlas, and then wholesome food was offered to you. Or your spouse, whom you adore, has adorned herself or himself for you. Or a travel opportunity arises for you, which carries with it a lot of worldly gain. Introspect and see if continuing fasting or the remaining fasting that remains becomes heavy and a chore or burdensome for you. Because it's a mustahab fast. You can now, for example, enter the presence of your spouse or even consume that food because it was a mustahab fast and this very wholesome food was offered to you. Or there was this travel opportunity which had worldly gain. Now the offer has been given and you can break it, but you want to remain fasting, the remaining fasting becomes a chore, becomes a burden for you. Do you say to yourself, when is this going to end? The quicker the better so I can do these objectives. Do you say to yourself, when is this going to end? When you yourself are aware. You say this in relation to fasting, but you yourself know when your maid or worker works for you reluctantly with burden, you'll never be satisfied with their quality of service. And such a reluctance in serving you will be a reason for you to discard them or distance yourself from them, or change your positive behavior and attitude towards those workers. Won't you do that if you knew they're doing it reluctantly, with no joy? Now, with fasting, when such an offer comes, and then we suddenly become burdened with fasting for the remaining hours, what will Allah say? When Allah sees you in a state of reluctance, doing something out of burden and chore, how is Allah going to treat you now? How will Allah see your action? And finally, the seventh scenario. Sayyid Ibn Tawus writes, suppose you're fasting a mustahab fast. So this is also a recommended fast. It won't apply for the obligatory fasts. And then a situation arises whereby breaking the fast is preferable and better than continuing with the fast. Okay, these circumstances which make breaking the fast preferable, these have been delineated by the Sharia. Okay, now something happens like that. Now in the example he says, a believer invites you over for a bite, and you know that by accepting you'll make them happy, and there's no obstacle on your part, there's no medical condition preventing you from accepting that believer's invitation, or you're not in a rush, for example. Okay, in such cases, accept the food, for this will be on a par with abiding by the command of Allah and His Messenger. Allah has said when the believer gives you an invitation, invites you over, and you're fasting, don't disclose that you are fasting, but accept the invitation, go there. But keep that fasting to yourself. Conceal it. And it's easy to conceal here because they don't know you're fasting. That secretive nature of fasting again arises here. And were you to continue with the fast, it shows it wasn't done for Allah's sake, because you were fasting. Then Allah says, when a believer invites you, you accept it. But you don't. When you don't, and there's no legitimate reason for not accepting it, when Allah tells you to accept it, it's better if you accept it, and it's more rewarding, but you don't, it means your fasting for Allah's sake has been compromised here. Another example he gives, whilst in a mustahab fast, you realize this mustahab fast, it's weakening you. It's weakening, you know, your strength to such a degree that you will refrain from executing other wajib or mustahab actions which are of equal importance, that are of more value than fasting. So not equal, maybe more equal, or let's say of more value than fasting. There are some obligatory or recommended actions which are more valuable than this mustahab fast. And when you have this mustahab fast, you're weakening yourself, and it prevents you from committing to those wajib or recommended actions which are more in value than this recommended fast which is weakening you. For example, the Friday ghusl, you know, the ceremonial major ablution, so to speak. Or, for example, reconciling two parties that are, you know, in argument with one another. That's much more recommended. Now, you're fasting, a recommended fast. You're so weak, you can't go and bring about reconciliation between the two parties. But reconciliation between the two parties is much more important than that fasting. And then Allah is saying, has given importance, has emphasized the importance of reconciliation, or has emphasized the importance of the Friday ghusl, for example. But you don't do these things, and the reason you don't do them is because you're weakened by a mustahab fast. Here, if you're doing it for Allah's sake, you would certainly you know, cut and break that mustahab fast so you can become attentive to the more important things. Here, one must discard the fast and deem as precious and greater that which Allah has deemed as precious and greater, and deem as lesser that which Allah has deemed as lesser, and never say to yourself, if I break my fast, what will those around me who are not aware of my situation or excuse for not fasting, what will they say? Otherwise, this will be riya, and this is a sin. So look how intentions can really play with you. Now, okay, in most of these delicate dimensions, it may not be applicable to the Sharia riya, but without a doubt, it's very applicable to the contaminating spiritual riya, where Allah's worship is compromised, but in more ways than that of the canonical Sharia riya. Inshallah, I'll stop here and we'll continue with Sayyid Haydar Amuli's writing in his book on fasting. وصلى الله على محمد وعلى آله وصحبه.